All right, well, we're looking at the fallout of the fall. We'll start in Genesis chapter 4 today, but I just want to do a quick recap of where we've been so far. And we've talked about these three big stages in our worldview glasses, how we see everything around us. We could look at any topic, any issue, any point of debate, and we want to recognize these three ideas, that in creation, God created everything perfectly. And then because of the fall, we spent a few weeks on that in Genesis 3. Here is where the effects of Adam and Eve's sin and how it introduces sin into the world, and sin infects people but affects everything. And the creation all around it is groaning, Romans 8 tells us, and as part of the result of Adam and Eve's sin and God's curse on Satan and the ground, but then also the punishment to Adam and Eve. And we spent some time last time just thinking through the brokenness of what it looks like in our world. And we realize that no part of creation is untouched by sin. And every part of creation that's broken is affected directly by sin. There's nothing else that we can say is the reason for that brokenness. But that's not the end of the story. We saw at the end last week the glimpses of grace, ways in which God begins to give previews of redemption. He gives clothes to Adam and Eve. He keeps them from living forever. That's goodness of God, to keep them from living forever in a broken world. And what we'll see today is kind of the next logical question developing out of that is this. Here's the key question we'll look at today. How does God respond to human sin? Yes, he told Adam, the day that you eat of this fruit, you will surely die. And we want to sort through what that looked like for Adam and Eve, but even for their generations, because even though they're fallen and they're in a cursed world, they still have children. And the kids have kids. But those kids are sinful. So how does it look like, and how does God interact with humanity as a whole in light of the fall? This really will have a zooming in and focusing on the idea of God's justice. How does God bring justice to a broken world where it's full of people who are sinning constantly? And that's what we see a little bit here. We're going to spend probably the most time on this first guy, Cain, but that's what you see there in your handout. You see Cain, we're going to call Cain a serial sinner. These are high-quality Google images. But I tried to find the ones that were a little realistic, not cartoonish, not comic, but somewhat close to what it could have been like. And so we'll kind of walk our way through some of this account with Cain and Abel, and see how God responds to Cain specifically. And we'll call Cain a serial sinner because he keeps adding sin on top of sin. But we see in Genesis chapter 4, really verses 1 through 3. Verse 4 is this contrast between Cain and Abel, right? Cain is the firstborn, and you can imagine what Eve's experience was like for the first time ever, having to give birth. No one else has done it before. She doesn't have any hearsay or stories, or her mom wasn't there to help her. She's just on her own. Adam, I'm sure, was right there with her. And so it's no surprise then that she says, I've gotten a man-child. I've given birth with the help of the Lord. Or it's like the Lord created Adam. I've been able to kind of create this human. And she's amazed, and she names him Cain. And then later she has his brother Abel. So Cain's older than Abel. What are the different jobs that they have? They grow up, and it's really neat to see the distinction in jobs. Abel's job is, he's the one who's working with the lambs or the flock. So even at the very beginning, one generation into humanity, we're going to notice this trend. Culture develops really quickly. The first humans were not cavemen. They were not, Neanderthals who starred in Geico commercials. These were people who were fully intelligent and frankly very, very creative so quickly, to the point where one generation in, they already have groups of domesticated animals that they know how to take care of and protect and use for their own good. They develop their own set of clothing, they're eating meat, and they're caring for these animals as well. While Cain, on the other hand, maybe follows the pattern of Adam, who's having to work for the ground. And so Cain is following Dad's example. He grows up watching Dad work with the ground, and Cain's got a green thumb. He's really good at what he's able to do. So naturally, he can bring in the produce. Abel is able to focus on the flocks themselves. And it's worth pointing out here, and we get another sense of this over in chapter 5, verse 3, that these two sons, Cain is definitely the first, Abel is definitely after Cain, but we also get the impression that there are a lot more of Adam and Eve's kids than just these two. So when we think of Adam and Eve's family, we don't think a family of four. That probably doesn't match what God's intention was. He blessed them and said, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth. So to think of Adam and Eve having, you know, ideal family of four, and one died, so let's have another one to replace him, now we have a new family of four. That's not the picture. Especially, let's look really quickly over in chapter 5, verse 3, verse 4. How old is Adam when he fathered Seth, the new heir or line of the promise to Eve? Chapter 5, verse 4. I'm sorry, verse 3. My eyes are a little bad today. He's 130 years old. You don't have two kids and then wait 130 years later and then have another son. This is most likely, and we see how long he's living. We'll see a graphic of this in a minute. That's a long time. They have a lot of kids here. But Cain and Abel are the ones who especially have this rivalry. And Cain is sensing that there's something not fair here. So for Cain, he's contrasted with Abel. And that contrast shows up most clearly here in chapter 4 when they bring sacrifices to God. So Abel brings the firstlings of his flock. And we're not told the details. We have to assume everybody knew what kind of sacrifice God expected to receive. And the only connection we see here in Genesis is this matches the first animals that were killed to provide the clothing for Adam and Eve. So in some way, this sacrifice is intended to remind them of what happened when they first sinned and God first covered their sin, their nakedness, at the end of chapter 3. It's pretty clear that Cain knew what he should have done, because God confronts him in verse 6. Why are you angry? Verse 7, if you've done well, don't you know if you did the right thing, you wouldn't have this issue? But apparently, in Cain's mind, I'm going to bring this offering instead. I'm going to bring the fruit of my work, my labor here, to present to God. It's helpful to see other passages. Hebrews chapter 11, Abel's sacrifice is just considered better. And as a result of that, it's testified to Abel that he was righteous. He brought the sacrifice in faith that God expected to see, that God required. Over in 1 John chapter 3, I think it is, it's really interesting here, Cain is described as having come from the evil one, and his deeds were evil. So even a sacrifice, Cain recognized, this is not what God is expecting. But, I mean, I'm sure it's fine. God knows how hard I worked on this. I'm just going to give this to him. But apparently he can tell God had regard for, God accepted Abel's offering. In some way, they all knew Abel's sacrifice is acceptable to God. What it looks like, we don't know, but it's really interesting to think about that. But clearly Cain's was not. And because of that, Cain's upset. He's frustrated. What's the effect that it has on him? Look at verse 5. How is he described? Because God doesn't accept his offering, he's angry. His face is droopy. He's glum. And I think that's why this picture really fits. Because Cain is an expressive character. He wears his emotions on his sleeve. He's right there. And what he feels, everybody knows. And so I'm upset. I can't believe he took Abel's. He didn't take mine. And it's interesting, it's like he's kind of, who's he angry with? Can't be angry with himself. I can't believe I did the wrong thing. No, really, the anger is ultimately directed to God. He expresses his anger eventually towards Abel, his brother. But he's angry at God because God didn't accept what he was trying to do. God's not getting with the program. So you see this pattern continuing from Adam and Eve. You know, they eat the fruit they're not supposed to. He offers a sacrifice he's not supposed to. Now they blame God. He's wanting to perhaps be angry with God as well. But again, we see God's goodness because God doesn't correct him. He questions him. He interacts with him. And this is where we say God is having this conversation with Cain. So the conversation then is full of questions. Question after question. Why are you angry? Why is your countenance fallen? What's wrong? It's really interesting, the idea of questioning someone about their anger, this matches a lot of God's conversation with Jonah, the prophet. At the end of Jonah, God has this kind of conversation. Why are you angry about this, Jonah? Let's think about it. And maybe Jonah matches Cain's response because he's like, he doesn't really respond the right way at the end of the account of Jonah. But in this case, he asks questions. And it's really neat to see that as well as asking questions, that's the first big idea. Don't you know, Cain, come on, you know this. You know what you need to do. You can be accepted. Your face can turn that frown upside down. You can have an improved facial expression. Your attitude can be better. Just offer the sacrifice I expect and I require. Cain, just obey. And he actually warns him if he doesn't, because there in verse 7, if you don't do well, it's a really interesting picture. Sin is pictured here as like a wild animal. And the word there in the NASB is it's crouching or it's ready to pounce. And it matches back, and there's a lot of similarities with chapter 3. We shouldn't be surprised. In chapter 3, there's a serpent that's deceiving Eve. Chapter 4, there's this wild animal ready to jump at Cain. If you walk out the door, if you let your guard down, Cain, if you're not ready, you live in a hostile world. Well, sin is the most hostile of all the creatures. It's personified here as this animal. Be careful, Cain. It's desirous for you. It wants to over-dominate you and take you over, but you must master it. You may remember that we saw the parallel. This matches the beginning of the marital conflict. That's part of the punishment given to Eve. The same conflict here. It wants to control you, but you've got to control it or dominate it. Obviously, for Eve, because both people are sinful, you'll never have a permanent ideal setting in that marriage interaction. But here, Cain clearly is supposed to overcome the sin. So God warns him. He not only questions him, but he warns him. Did that work? Well, verse 8, we see several things that Cain does. And when you read it, just try to read it like it's a slow-moving movie. Get a sense of it. NASB says he told Abel his brother. ESV says he spoke with Abel his brother. I think King James says he was talking with Abel his brother. It's really an incomplete sentence. We don't know what the end of it. It's like he told him something. But we're left hanging with the specifics. What did he say? And it's interesting, the Greek version of the Old Testament for the Jewish and Jesus' time, they just tried to finish that sentence. So Cain said to Abel, his brother, let's go outside. Not like you want to take it outside, but more like, let's talk. Let's go in private. Whatever he said, the point is he's hiding his intentions. Let's just talk. But then now we're going to go out to the field. And now because we're going out to the field, he plans this out. He rises up against Abel, his brother, and kills him. He plans the whole thing. I'm going to walk with you out here to the field, and now that we're away from everybody else, I'm going to choose to kill you. And it's interesting, all he had to do to obey God was to offer the lamb, to kill the lamb. And because he doesn't, instead he chooses to kill his brother. And it's graphic and it's tragic. I mean, this is the first murder. We're used to murder in the sense of we're familiar with the idea. And news stories or TV shows give you the idea. But this is just gruesome. There are sometimes movie scenes kind of surprise us or shock us with their reality like that. I think for me, there's a scene from Lord of the Rings, one of the movies, where one character kills another character. And it'll show the detail, but I remember as growing up watching, I was like, oh, that's what murder, oh! And there's this repulsion that I had to it. We're supposed to have that repulsive reaction to this. He killed his brother? God just warned him to stop being angry at God, and in response, he plans it out. He brings his brother to the side. He gets even with his brother because God doesn't accept him. It doesn't make any sense at all. But that's Cain. He's a serial sinner. And very similar to how God responds to Adam and Eve is how God confronts Cain. He comes to him with questions. And what's the first question he asks in verse 9? Where's your brother? He asks Adam, where are you? Now he asks Cain, where's your brother? He knows the whole time, but he gives him a chance to confess, to open up about it. And just like Adam gives a half answer, Cain, he's a little more intense now. He's going to respond with his own question. I don't know. Am I in charge of my brother? Am I, you know, responsible for what happens to my brother? Well, actually, you are kind of responsible for what happened to your brother. So, a little tongue-in-cheek here. He gives this harsh response, and now God answers with more questions. And so, and this is really a powerful question that I need to use this more with my own sons, but God asks him a question, what have you done? And if you search what have you done, or the idea of doing something in Genesis, that happens pretty frequently. We'll look back in chapter 3, verse 13. This is the question that God asks the woman Eve. What is this you have done? It's asked in the Tower of Babel. They see what these people did in making this tower. Or later on, when Abraham lies about his wife, what have you done? This Laban accuses Jacob of deceiving him. What have you done? And there's this question that is meant to really appeal to the guilty conscience and really confront them with the facts. It's like you're grabbing a mirror and you're shoving it in their face. Look at yourself. What did you do? What have you done? And so God is trying to do that to Cain. And then he shows, I knew the whole time. The voice of your brother's blood is crying to me from the ground. It's an interesting picture here. The blood of Abel's body just poured out of him so he isn't killed with poison. He bled to death, essentially, we'd have to assume. The blood is poured out and it stained the ground. And it stained the ground that Cain has been so capable of developing. And so now because of that, God gives him this verdict, this conclusion. Well, because of that now, you are cursed. The first time God curses a person. You, Cain, are cursed, and you're cursed from the ground. Now your curse is connected to the ground. And so no longer can you cultivate it like you wanted to. Instead, NASB calls it a vagrant and a wanderer. You will be a homeless wanderer, as one translation says. The idea is you can't live off the ground anymore. You're going to have to scavenge. You're going to have to trade for food. The ground's not going to cooperate with you. And it matches the same kind of punishment that God gave to Adam and Eve and to Satan. Whatever you were good at before, that's the nature of your punishment. And God's justice is so clearly on display here by speaking to people and punishing them in a way that they will particularly feel it. God speaks our language when he punishes us. He knows how to punish in a way to grab our attention. And a lot of principles here for how we would want to show justice as well. But because God knows each person individually in a perfect way, he's able to bring justice to that person in a way that really connects with them. So because of this, he punishes Cain. Does Cain accept this? No, he objects. I can't believe this. Cain says, verse 13, my punishment's too heavy for me. I can't handle this, God. You're punishing me too hard. Yes, I killed the guy. Yes, I planned it out, premeditated. Yes, I tried to hide it and pretend I didn't know what happened. But it's still, this punishment's too mean. Because the ground, and he's kind of repeating what God has already said. You've driven me this way from the face of the ground. And here's interesting, just like Adam and Eve hid from the presence of God, so Cain says, I will be hidden from your face. And he repeats the idea of being a vagrant wanderer. I'm going to wander, and then, but God, whoever finds me, I might die. And you see the irony of this? He's just killed his brother. And just a few chapters later in Genesis 6, God says, if you kill a human being, by a human being you should be killed. The idea of capital punishment is fair. A life for a life, because humans are made in the image of God. It's neat that at this point, a couple factors stand out to me. First of all, there's no human institution to bring justice yet. God doesn't say, all right, Cain, you're going to jail. You're going to go see the judge. God's the judge. There's no human judge. So God is the judge. He gives the verdict. And in this verdict, he actually shows delayed justice, in a sense, because he doesn't kill Cain on the spot. And in fact, he keeps Cain from being killed. So even though in our minds we think, well, Cain deserves to die, in God's mind, I'm going to delay his death. And not to say this doesn't undermine the reasoning for capital punishment at all, but it is neat that in God's mind, justice can include delayed death and let him suffer on this earth for a while before he actually dies. And God prevents further bloodshed by putting this mark on Cain, verse 15, that shows that no one else can kill him. And then another tragic verse is verse 16. Cain goes out from the presence of the Lord. So you see a lot of similarities, right? Does that sound familiar? chapter 3, they hide from the presence of the Lord behind the trees. Here, he goes out from the presence. He settles in the land of wandering. Nod is the Hebrew word for wandering. He goes out and settles in the land of the wilderness, of the wanderers, east of Eden. And so this is sobering for Cain to accept this, but it's powerful for us. And we'll try to draw a few more conclusions about the character of God in a result of this, but we'll need to keep going on for right now. So Cain is this serial sinner. After him, we'll call Lamech. Lamech comes at the end, five generations after Cain. And this is the end of chapter 5 now. That's fine. I'm calling him a serial sinner. Like he sins and sins and sins and sins and covers his tracks and gets worse and worse and worse. Sorry. That's all right. Maybe he did kill other people. And that actually matches the idea of Lamech, because Lamech is five generations later. And you see the generations named after Cain. You have Enoch, Irad, Mahujael, Methushael, and then Lamech. We're not told how old they are, so that the genealogy is not important. It's just the point, it's a connection. This guy Lamech, he came from that guy Cain. You think Cain was bad? Let's read about this guy Lamech. He's even worse. First of all, it's kind of obvious. How many wives does he have? Verse 19. For the first time in human history, as far as recorded history here, there's a guy who decides to marry two ladies. And that's completely revolutionizing the pattern that God set with Adam and Eve. Cain only had one wife. Adam only has one wife. But now five generations in, one guy decides, I'm going to have two. And he's going to brag to them, these two ladies. I'm skipping now to verse 23. We're overlooking a few facts here. We'll get to that in a few weeks. We'll try tie the idea of culture and development a little bit more, but we're just going to skip to verse 23 now. Lamech is talking to his two wives, and he demands their attention. Hey, you, listen to me. I don't want to read too much into this, but I don't hear much consideration, and he's not celebrating his wives like Adam celebrated his wife, but he's demanding their attention. Hey, you, listen to me. Give heed to my speech. What does he speak about? What is he bragging about? End of verse 23. Murder. I killed someone. And you look at the context there. Why did he kill him? He wounded me. He hit me. And who is the person that he kills? The one party is called a man, and Nasby is called a boy, maybe like a young warrior. So here's Lamech. He's an older guy, apparently. We don't know all the details, but apparently a younger person hit him. Can you believe that? And because they hit him, I killed him. Ha ha ha! And he brags to his two wives about the fact that I killed him. But he hit me. And because of that, if Cain is going to be avenged sevenfold, then I can be avenged 77-fold. If Cain has protection from God seven times, if Cain is protected by God for his murder, then I'm protected like ultimate, the infinite amount past that. Because God protected Cain, he better protect me because that guy hit me. So I deserve God's protection because he deserved to die. It doesn't make any sense. We shake our heads at this. This is a man who doesn't have a clear sense of justice at all. He brags about killing someone. And then he brags about the protection that he gets. Because, you know, he's a descendant of Cain after all. I've inherited God's protection. How warped this is. And so these are two men. They really demonstrate the just how quickly sin affects our thinking and our actions. You see how selfish they are. They are just willing to hurt other people, kill other people, for personal benefit. And they expect God to defend them at the same time. Does that sound familiar to today? People who, I'm going to get what I want, and I'm going to hurt you, but you better not hurt me. And God has to protect me. That sounds a lot like our society today. I'm always the exception to the rule, but no one else is. And the idea of universal justice or laws applied evenly to everyone, that doesn't fit in our worldview here. We believe in a justice that protects us and hurts everybody else. Or it gets everybody else back. Because I was hurt, therefore I get to hurt you twice as much. And kill you even. And no one should hurt me at all. How warped is that justice? That's a human version of this, though. And what's amazing to me is that God just lets this account be written down. There's Lamech, and God doesn't say one word. God doesn't interrupt Lamech. He doesn't strike him dead on the spot. He just lets him finish talking. End of story. But then you contrast that with Seth and his being born as kind of the one through who, the son of Eve, who will eventually be able to conquer the snake's offspring. It's really powerful. So we'll move on then. Chapter 5, we're about to go a little more quickly. Do we have another extra handout? I want to make sure I'm not missing any blanks or anything. Thanks, Diane. Really simple. These people here in chapter 5, they're not really bad guys. They're just, we're going to call them normal sinners. They're just people who just live life. We're not giving details about them. A few details, but not really many. So as you look over chapter 5, we'll notice first of all that Adam fathers this son Seth, and you notice the language, chapter 5, verse 3, he's a son in his own likeness, according to his image. That sounds familiar, right? Just like Adam is considered the image of God, Seth is the image of Adam, and so we know the image of God passes down for all these generations. If you go to Luke chapter 3, you see that in reverse. Jesus is the son of this guy, the son of this guy, the son of this guy. Who's the son of Adam? Who is the son of God? And you see that consistency there. But as you look at chapter 5, what stands out to you about these people? Kind of just survey in your own mind. What's unusual? They lived a long time. And you see this graphic up here, right? Adam's 930 years, Seth's 912, Enosh 905. Mahalalel, they all made fun of him. He died before he turned 900. Enoch, a youngin, at 365. And then, you know, Methuselah is the really, really old guy. He's almost 1,000. That's a long time, right? That's impressive. These guys lived a long time. You'll notice in all these phrases, they had a lot of other children. They had other sons and daughters besides this one individual. And I know Pastor Tim pointed this out when we had a look at a book in Genesis. You have, from Adam and Eve, humanity just multiplying everywhere and spreading everywhere. But God also highlights one individual in each generation who carries on the promise until we eventually land with Noah here at the flood. And the same thing with Abraham, he focuses in. And so I didn't look up numbers, but I know there are a lot, the assumption is by the time you get to Noah, the world is just full of people. And just multiplied so quickly. You think Israel multiplying into millions of people in Egypt over 400 years is impressive. Imagine all the people filling up. And so many generations, so many people born during each individual's lifetime. You can do the math if you want to in your head, what it would look like, but it just compounds very quickly. That's the point. But these are normal people, right? So they all have long lives, they all have lots of kids. Look at chapter 5. Let's do verse 4. We'll just look at Adam. The days of Adam after he became the father of Seth were 800 years, other sons and daughters. So all the days Adam lived were 930 years. What are the last three words of verse 5? What are the last three words of verse 5?
He died.
And he died. Look at verse 8. The last three words. And he died. What about verse 11? What about Enosh? 905 years, and he died. And there's the one exception of Enoch, but the exception shows the rule. The pattern is, even if you live a long time, as a normal sinner, a normal human being, you still die. And this really points us back to the idea that God promised Adam, the day that you eat this fruit, you will surely die. Did Adam die physically that day? Obviously not, right? He lived 930 years, and I'll just note here, he didn't have to grow up first. He was born, he was created as an adult. Little small thing, but that speaks a lot to when you have the creation evolution debates, because God can create things that already look older than they actually are. So God can create an adult human. He can create stars that are in reality billions of light years away, but their light is hitting Earth the same day he creates them. Really interesting idea. God creates things with apparent age. He creates trees with fruit on them already. But the point is, what was the point? Oh, you will surely die. The day he eats, he doesn't die. But the day he eats, he begins to die. And the aging process kicks in. The body cells begin to die every day. Skin cells need to be replaced every day as soon as he eats. So he does begin to die. And we know ultimate death is defined as separation from God. That's the second death in Revelation. So God kept his word, but in such a way that he delays his ultimate physical death. God kept his word and showed great mercy to Adam and Eve. And really, 930 years? That's mercy. That is justice, but that is extremely delayed. And each of these men, they were born sinful. They were born in the likeness of Adam, who sinned against God. But you see the mercy of God. I'm going to let you live 900 years, even though you sinned. And the moment you sinned, you deserve physical death at that moment. But I'm going to just delay this out of my goodness. So we see this pattern, and I wish we could spend more time with Enoch, but it's neat seeing that God does show grace to individuals. We'll focus on that next time. But here, we're just trying to see the fallout of the fall, what it looks like. In this case, you see a pattern again and again that sin passes on. And it's really neat, too. You just look it over. Adam overlaps with a lot of generations, right? Adam overlaps 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Adam died before Enoch disappeared, I think. I need to say, yeah, he did. So Enoch's alive, and he goes up to be with God just 50-some years after Adam dies. It's so cool to see the overlap. We think of these guys as kind of end-to-end in lifetime. There's a gigantic amount of overlap to the point where when Noah's flood comes, these two older men, Methuselah and Lamech, they die almost the year of the flood. So it's really interesting. Like, did they help build the ark? Were they preaching while Noah was doing the work? We don't know the details. Noah is the main character in the story, but they were still present. It's really interesting. But that's the idea. God works with normal sinners, and he still lets them die. And it really highlights, because every other genealogy that we see, we don't find the phrase, and he died, and he died. Go to chapter 11. This is Noah's kids throughout the book of Genesis. Here, Esau's children. Here's Ishmael's sons. Nowhere do you see, and he died, and he died, and he died. That's being impressed on us here. Look how long they lived, and then realize that they died anyway. Okay, we'll move on really quickly here. We'll summarize really basically this last point, the beginning of chapter 6. That this is what we'll call normalized sin. Sin is becoming so common nowadays. And the beginning of chapter 6 is a head-scratcher for a lot of people. Talks about the sons of God seeing the daughters of men are beautiful. And there are different options for what that means. It could be the sons of God are Seth's descendants, because when Seth, at beginning of Seth, people began to call on the name of the Lord, chapter 4, verse 26. So maybe Seth's line was unique and they were called children of God. That matches the idea from Luke 3. Other people think this is taken to mean angels who took on human bodies, and it sounds a lot more mythological to us. On the other hand, we know in Job that the phrase sons of God does refer to angels, and other places as well. In Proverbs 8 talks about the sons of God, if I'm not mistaken. Let me check real quick. I think Proverbs 8 uses that phrase. It does not. I'm sorry. I'm mixing up creation accounts. But there are places that the sons of God does refer to angels as well. And so some people think maybe this is angels who ended up, they saw these human ladies and they wanted to be humans, so they could sleep with them. So they either controlled a human body or took on a human body. It's weird. We have a lot of questions rise in our minds. I'm just going to say, I don't think we should rule out the idea of the angels. I'll just put it that way. It sounds weird, I know, but weird things happen in Scripture. And there are a few verses at the end of the New Testament in Jude and 2 Peter which may reference this idea. And to me, that fits. I don't think we need to be convinced one way or the other. And really, the whole point of this passage is to show us, can you believe the scandal? That's the point of the story. It's a scandalous thing. Chapter 6, can you believe that this kind of marriage worked out? They had kids? Oh, shocking. It's a scandalous transgression that's happening, regardless of who are the people doing it. We don't want to lose the effect of the story. It's a shock to us. Because of that, verse 3, God says, all right, that's it. My spirit will not strive. The word strive, it's a really nebulous word. It can mean contending with, or just, I'm not going to let these people survive much longer. So that's it. I'm going to give a countdown. Verse 3, I'm going to count down 120 years. They've got 120 years left. That they just crossed the line. That moral transgression is so heinous, so severe, that's it. I'm going to count down. I will not, my spirit, which I breathed into Adam, I'm not going to let that spirit continue much longer. That's it. I've got to wipe out this generation. Verse 4 references Nephilim, unusual men of renown, they're described. But I want us to focus here at the end, though, on this verse 5. This is where we'll finish. Yeah, Jack.
So you're saying that in that verse, just before, that it cut down on future lifespans, that's why people don't live as long as 900 years because of that verse?
That's a great question. Some people think that's what that verse means. Some people think it means from 120 years from that point, then God's going to send the flood. So they have 120 years left before the flood comes.
Can you read that verse again?
Oh, you can. Genesis chapter 6, verse 3. So maybe you can sort through it and come to your own conclusion about that.
Thank you.
I think both answers seem to fit. To me, it seems a little more like it's a countdown to the flood, because he says, I will not strive with man forever or endlessly. But I'm not going to be dogmatic at all about that. Again, the big point of the story is horrific scandal. God says, you've crossed the line. I've got to make some serious changes. That obviously would include a much reduced lifespan after the flood. Definitely. So that's part of it, for sure.
But the only thing is, I know that sin carries on from generation to generation, mm-hmm. but why should we as adults suffer and have a shorter lifespan because of what happened 4,000 years mm-hmm. ago or whatever? I mean, why are we getting punished or not being punished?
Yeah, we die too. I think we'll try to answer that at the end. Can we just do this verse, and we'll kind of wrap things up here? So here's the verse that kind of summarizes what it was like in Noah's world. The Lord saw that the wickedness of man, and just try to chew your way through every word of this verse and appreciate God is assessing this world populated by these people. But here's the conclusion that he has to come to. This is God's conclusion. The Lord sees this. Wickedness is great on the earth. Well, not only was the actions great, but even the thoughts of his heart. And it's the intent of the thoughts of his heart. It's every intent of the thoughts of his heart. You just let one word pile on top of another. You realize this sin is just infecting everything about humanity. So everything he wants to think about in his heart is evil. And it's only evil. It's not half and half. It's 100% evil. And it was only evil continually, nonstop. And so God is assessing the people at that time, and the sin had so infected their minds that there's just everything you can think of was constantly. And we'll look later, next time, how it even affected the world. Verse 11 and 12 of chapter 6 talk about their sin. It's like polluting the earth. The earth is corrupted by their sin. Just like Abel's blood is crying out from the ground that it polluted. So like their sin is just touching every aspect of creation. And we want to conclude with this idea. God is heartbroken. Everything he's created, so good, so very good. And in delaying this justice, this is the natural result of sin. It is so destructive. And it's so contagious. It spreads everywhere and corrupts everything. Yeah, Diana, what are you thinking?
I just want to go back to the sons of God question.
Okay.
I need to go back. You kind of said that it might include angels.
Mm-hmm.
Would those angels then be fallen angels? And then when Adam and Eve first sinned, did that bring on, I guess, fallen angels? Did their
okay.
sin
Good question.
was...
So your question is about like the evil? What happened first?
Kind of
like the humans
or
funny.
I think that the angels took these women to be their wives.
Yeah, it's so
that
weird.
Just kind of blew my mind on the concept of what angels mm-hmm. are supposed to be, unless Adam sin also corrupted.
Yeah. The short answer is because Satan was tempting Eve first. Mm-hmm. A lot of people think Satan and all the other angels with him okay. were fallen first, and then. So that had already happened, and then he tempts Eve and Adam. So Adam and Eve's sin affects humanity in the created world,
okay.
but not so much the angelic realm.
Okay.
That happened first. And that's kind of our conclusion from looking at verses. Maybe afterwards we can do a few other verses that kind of match that idea where God reserves some angels for he's already banished some angels to hell because of something that happened earlier in time. And some people, and there's a reference, enough references there that some people think maybe this is an example. They crossed the line. God said, "That's it. You're banished to hell early." You, anyway, I'd like us to finish this idea if we can. This is so important for us. So then, what do we say? This, what is God like? This is the conclusion we have to come to. What is God like? What would you say based on all the things we're seeing here?
Patient.
Yeah.
He didn't zap him.
He didn't zap him. Yeah. Yeah, there's three ideas that I have. He's just and patient and merciful. And it's neat that he's just. You know, when Adam and Eve sinned, he confronted them. When Cain sinned, he confronted him. He knows about every sin that is ever committed. No one can sin and hide it from God. No one can sin in private. Or in Adam's case, let's sin and then cover ourselves and hide behind a tree. In Cain's case, let's kill my brother and neglectfully try to hide the body. Right? Dig a hole. Get him in there, and then the blood continues to ooze out and soaks the ground. Let's hide my sin. There is never a time that God does not know about sin. And every time he sees it, he addresses it. What's amazing to us is you combine that with the idea of his patience, because he delays the full justice for that sin. Delays to the point where he waits 900 some years, right? Before they died. He delays in that when he confronts Cain, or even he overhears Lamech bragging to his wives, he doesn't step in the spot. I think for us, we expect justice to be, fix it right now. But in his wisdom, he's going to delay his justice. Not that he won't bring it out, but this is an eternal God we're talking about. So for him to wait a little bit of time, it's not concerning to him at all. In the Psalms, he says, 1,000 years are like a day. And then Peter connects that idea with a day is like 1,000 years. Time has no effect on God at all. When he sees it, okay, in his ledger, that action requires this punishment. Done. It's only a matter of time. But he's patient when he does it, and in his patience, he really is showing mercy because he's limiting the effects of sin. Cain should have been killed, but God in his mercy says, I'll let you live, and I'll actually make sure no one does kill you. He protects a murderer. Talk about mercy. He delays. He lets Lamech brag. He observes the wickedness of men on the earth in Genesis 6, and he says, that's it. I've had it. You only have 120 more years. I mean, with my kids, when I get annoyed and exasperated, it's like, that's it. An immediate action. God says, that's it, 120 years. Talk about patience. Talk about mercy on people. So we want to connect it to us because we want to finish up in time to get up the hill in time to set up for 1 o'clock. What will you do in two ways? First of all, how do you respond to his justice? And I really just welcome your input on this. How can I live in light of God's justice? The fact that God's justice, and this is a key word, is certain. God's justice is guaranteed. How does that affect the way we live?
I think we praise him for the gospel and still live under his fear. You know, but praise him for Jesus.
Yeah, yeah. There's a return to the gospel, and we see that Jesus took on the full... He fulfilled God's righteous requirements. God's justice is completely satisfied. Isaiah 53, it pleased the Father to crush him. And in his justice, he must punish sin. it is impossible for God not to punish sin. But it's amazing that he would choose to punish his son, who stood in our place. What else? Think about...
Okay. The way we live. Just with that conscious knowledge that...
Yeah.
He sees all sin.
Absolutely, yeah. Because we experience grace so much, it's easy to forget the fact that God does judge sin. The fact that I sinned yesterday and I woke up today, I could begin to think I got away with it. But God says, I'm just delaying my justice for you. And there's some verses I'll read here in a minute that really flesh that out. We are so used to God's delayed justice that we can easily forget the fact that he does bring justice. And that should have an effect on Christians too. The fact that God punished Jesus doesn't mean I can sin however I want now. And there's a long dialogue in the church and in Romans warning us from that tendency, which we all have. So we need God's help to fear him. And this is where Hebrews 12 talks about the idea of God raising us as a child. He disciplines us sometimes. There are real consequences to sin in this life for a believer. And we are foolish to think that God's justice doesn't fit in that category at all. Another big talking point would be how we respond when other people treat us unfairly. That's a big talking point. Because if I don't believe that God is just, then I have to fix it, right? So you struck me, I'm allowed to kill you. And it's injustice in response. And really, this is where we see a lot of this in our society today. People who sense injustice and they want to see it addressed, but they don't know how to diagnose it, and they don't know how to fix it. But it's just wrong. So let me just spew my frustration at the world and see what happens. And I appreciate the motives. I'm going to assume the best intentions for people. They're broadly called social justice warriors. A desire to bring justice, that's great. But often it's absent an understanding of God's justice. And so it's a human effort to fix something that everything we touch, we mess up. And so there's a frustration for people who try to fix things that cannot be fixed. But as believers, we want to try to, as best we can, see God's justice played out, but also with the understanding that we'll never see perfect justice in this life. And that relieves us of the pressure of trying to make it happen. I do a very poor job of playing God. I do a very poor job of being a perfect judge because I can't. And that's where I'm glad to just acknowledge to him, I'm rolling it off my shoulders. I've done everything I can, and it's still not fixed, and I don't think I could do anything else, and whatever else I do is going to make it worse. You see it, right? And your justice is certain? Good. The last idea, though, has to do with his delayed justice. And this kind of connects with the same idea. What do we do about his delays? When God delays justice on us, that's mercy. And there are some verses here. Romans chapter 2. God explains this. Chapter 2, verses 3 through 6. Do you suppose this, O man, when you pass judgment on those who practice evil things and you do the same yourself, that you will escape the judgment of God? Do you think lightly of the riches of his kindness and tolerance and patience, not knowing that the kindness of God leads you to repentance? And Paul's talking to religious people who think, God's impressed with me because he let me wake up today. And I'm doing all the right thing. And he says, listen, don't you know that God gave you another day as a chance to repent? Turn to him now. Same idea as in Romans chapter 9, verses 22 and 23. God endures with much patience vessels of wrath prepared for destruction. God allows sinful people to continue to live on this earth. And one of the reasons is that so that he will show mercy on other people around them. God could wipe us all out today and be fair about that. But he delays because he wants other people to come to Christ. And then how do we respond to his delays with other people? And that's hard. What if I see other people keep sinning and they keep getting away with it? Let me suggest one other passage is Psalm 73. Psalm 73, maybe you can read that on your own later today. But Psalm 73 is a very transparent psalm where he's praying, Dear God, everybody who sins gets away with it. How is that fair of you? And God, and his basic conclusion is, actually, that's God delaying his justice. That's God's mercy. Until I went into the temple of God, I put my biblical worldview glasses on. Then I saw the end of the story. And then I realized that even if they can die, if I'm Hugh Hefner and I live a full and a filthy life without any sign of God's judgment, I still die. And then that judgment hits with righteous perfection. And then when we see that perspective from Psalm 73, that gives us hope. The last idea I have is kind of funny. This is, and I don't want to make light of this, but this is an illustration that came to my mind. You've ever seen the show Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? As the questions get harder, this is Regis, the original guy. Everybody else is a fake. This is the original guy. This is a game show where he'll ask a question to someone, and the further along, the harder the questions get, the more more money you can make. Often he'll just play with their mind a little bit, and they'll say, "I think this is the answer," and then he'll say, "Are you sure?" And I'll kind of talk with him. But it's like he's wanting to make sure they really know what they're doing before they make a final answer. And in one sense, I see God doing this. You just sinned. Are you sure? You sure you want to do that? Let me ask you a question. I'm going to give you a chance to repent. Are you sure? And he lets a sinful person kind of harden their will even more. The longer they live, the more they harden their will. The more they fully express their sinfulness, the more just God's verdict will seem to them. Sometimes God delays justice to reinforce the sinfulness of that person's human heart. So he delays. Is that your final answer? I'm going to give you another chance. I'm going to give you another day to think about it. And then that next day, they sin just as much. That is God and his delayed justice saying, now we know for sure that this is the right verdict for you. It's a terrifying thing to think about. Anyway, okay, we're close to 12:30. We need to stop. But we praise God for his justice and praise God for his delays. And that helps us to make sense of the broken world that we're in today.